Like a cold shower bath on a winter's morning, a discipline which would have made Shakespeare not merely a great genius, but a great artist had he known more about it. Both are descriptions, justifications even, of what the intensive study of Greek and Latin can do for the individual. Or is Latin worth knowing simply, as one classicist in the public eye has put it, so you can read what is written in it? In the UK, what you believe about the merits of classical learning is a matter of public and political urgency. The Department for Education has announced that starting in February, it will not continue its Latin excellence programme in state schools launched in 2021. These are straitened times for the British state. Today, I'm joined by author, classicist and critic Daisy Dunn, Armand Dongour, Professor of Classical Languages and Literature at Oxford University, and Paul Lay, EI's Senior Editor, to discuss the ancient inheritance, its grand history and modern significance. Daisy and Armand, where and how did your lifelong engagement with the classical languages begin?
I'd say a very, very long time ago. I mean, as a child, my parents are both artists. They took my sister and I off on holiday to various galleries, museums, and I was always drawn to the oldest thing in the room. And sort of without knowing that classics was a subject, that classics was something I could go on to read, I just had some kind of affinity with, you know, very ancient things. And then it came to sort of school level, and I was studying sort of class civ, I think, first of all, when I was about 11, and then Latin. And then I got to 17 and realised I had no Greek. And back then, that was kind of a bad thing. You needed to have Greek if you wanted to go on to read classics. So I had to take that up and ended up reading classics at university. And I think my love for it really grew more and more.
So back to the sources. Armand, what about you?
Mine was much more of a language love from a very early age. So age 7, I go to a school where they're teaching Latin. And we're sitting in the classroom, and in walks John Evans, the Latin teacher. Without a word, he draws a picture on the board, a blackboard, those were blackboards in those days, with chalk of a young woman's face with flowing hair. And by the way, he was a marvellous draftsman. He's dead now, but he was a wonderful artist. And he says to the class, "Haec puella est." And then he makes a gesture and says, "Puellam amo." And the amazing thing was, I thought, bloody hell, I already know what he's saying. Mm. This is a girl, I love the girl. And that just completely sparked my imagination for the language. After that, I just spent a lot of time just doing all the textbooks that we were put in front of us. And John Evans then realised that I was a complete, madly keen young Latinist. So he took me aside and said, "Look, we used to teach Greek, we don't anymore, but I'm going to teach you Greek." So I started Latin at 7 and Greek at 8. And I loved them both ever since.
What do you make of, Daisy, what do you make of the utilitarian arguments for teaching and learning classics beyond just the simple love of it? The idea that by learning Latin you become, say, X percent better at English or maths, subjects which self-evidently don't need to justify their usefulness?
Well, I think these are useful political tools, primarily. I mean, I think classics is one of those subjects overall where you seem to be having to make this argument to justify it again and again and again. I can't think of another subject over the last sort of decade or more where you've had to argue, oh, this is a really necessary, really helpful subject in the same way as you have for classics. I don't see that happening for other subjects. And I think there is something to be said for the fact that, you know, learning Latin does make you better at English. I don't remember sitting in my English lessons at school reading Jane Eyre or something and a teacher saying, "Oh, look, there's a subjunctive," or "Oh, look, there's a gerund." You don't learn vocabulary like that within the English curriculum. It's useful from a sort of, you know, literary perspective to have some grounding in it.
It's the ratchet, a subject that is in decline. You know, in 1959, almost 50,000 students took Latin O-levels, which was the GCSE equivalent. In 1987, 20,000. In 2024, only around 5,000. A subject that's in decline needs to argue for its usefulness, I guess.
It does, and I think particularly because of the period you're discussing, a lot happened there. Yeah. I mean, 1960 was the year when Latin, I think, stopped being obligatory for entry to Oxford. It stopped being obligatory at O-level as well.
Yeah.
And then in 1988, national curriculum comes in and Latin is no longer sort of seen as an essential compulsory subject. It's one that's made optional. So, you know, the decline actually falls in trend with the...
But it's interesting that in that same period, it's hardly also true that interest in the ancient world has declined. I mean, last year, the British Museum's landmark exhibition, Legion, Life in the Roman Army, regularly sold out. It was wildly popular. The bestseller lists regularly topped by books on ancient history. Paul, does it matter if so many people still show interest in the ancient world or drawn to it, that the languages have gone into abeyance?
Well, I've always argued, I mean, when I was at editor of History Today, and when I was even as now at Engelsberg Ideas, I've always argued from an historical perspective, because I am a historian, I'm not a classicist at all, but I always argued that there were two principles on which the editorial was based, and that was geographical breadth, that you looked at history in the widest possible terms so that you looked at a genuinely global history, and that you had chronological depth. And that meant that you went back as far as you could possibly go, and that includes, you know, Ice Age, so, you know, as far back as possible. And that's been pushed back even further by developments in DNA sources and various other stuff that Eric Hobsbawm talked about 25 years ago now, and which there's been advances. And obviously, language is absolutely crucial to that, whether it's the former, that geographical idea of studying, as you've already mentioned, languages such as Arabic, living languages such as Arabic, Mandarin, Persian, Russian, which has fallen into terrible decline. This is for aesthetic reasons. You are introduced to cultures that are rich and resonant and ancient when you look at those. I think there's also the intellectual. You've already argued that the study of ancient languages, and I would suggest also modern languages, particularly extra-European languages, does enhance one's intellectual abilities and one's knowledge and be able to compare and contrast. But I think there's also, for the UK as well and for every country, a strategic reason why that's talked. When you talk about people who have policymakers, whether in the Foreign Office or outside, who are involved in that, they're very, very concerned about the fact that at the top level, language learning has declined precipitously. And this was once a country that was admired for a mastery of ancient languages and languages such as Arabic and Farsi. And I think all of those are important. And I've long been an advocate of that. But I think there's something to inquire as to why Greek and Latin, the classical languages, have this particular purchase, as there is to a certain extent, as Daisy's pointed out, already a decline. And so one feels a kind of desperation to make that case, because you can see them just disappearing, and that would be a genuine tragedy. But I think there's also, as always in Britain, a class aspect, and this is talk about elites as metrics, which is always there in almost everything in British society.
Conversations about education almost always become sectarian, almost immediately. But I wonder whether the counter-argument to that is that our great tradition and expertise in, say, Oriental languages was built on classicists as well.
Absolutely. You know,
a lot of them
and
started
German,
as classicists.
And German in the late 19th century and early 20th century, the rise of the PhD and people like Ranke's ideas about sources and various other stuff. Germany had a huge influence on that as well.
So, Armand, I mean, we're getting into that. What can classics do for a country that seems to be domestically increasingly kind of polyglot in a way, but also a kind of outpost of American culture, probably less linked to its European inheritance, and classics is central to that?
Yes, I mean, there are lots of different elements to this, and let me just take the language element first. So, I mean, classics as the study of the ancient world, in particular Roman Greece, but using Latin and Greek as tools for getting into those cultures. Why study Latin? Well, there are lots of utilitarian reasons. There's a ton of proof that those students who do it increase their abilities and their grades in all sorts of subjects. So Classics for All, a charity which is putting Latin teaching into the state sector and managed to get to about 80,000 pupils in the last 10 years, has done statistics on that and shown that whoever does that particular course of study does better in whatever they go on to do, whether it's physics or maths or a linguistic or historical subject. Now, you could say, well, that's because the people who choose to do it, because it's an option, are already predisposed to doing well in intellectual matters. And it can only help to enhance their intellect if they do an extra subject like Latin. They could just as well do Mandarin or Arabic or Russian or whatever. So that's true, I think, that one shouldn't say Latin is the only way into enhancing your intellectual abilities and skills. I mean, I think Daisy's right to talk about one's writing skills being tremendously enhanced by the grammatical structures of Latin. I mean, in some ways, what is helpful about Latin as opposed to the other languages is that you have to learn it grammatically. Which is not to say you can't learn it in other ways, and I'm a great advocate of active Latin, which means you can actually speak it when you're teaching it, but you have to learn what a subject and an object is. You have to understand what different parts of speech are and so on. And you know, I'm married to a professor of psychology who occasionally will put a bit of her writing in front of me saying, this doesn't look right. And I'll immediately say, well, that's because you've done this or that. She says, oh, why didn't someone tell me that when I was, you know, studying English at school? Mm. That was the problem. You don't tend to teach people grammar if you're teaching them English, but you have to teach them grammar if you're teaching them Latin. And then it becomes obvious. Yeah. That, you know, we might use, we you know, obviously we have accusatives, as it were, object cases in English. You can't say he hit he, we say he hit him. Why do we say hit him? Mm-hmm. Because that's the object case. And then you see that in the Latin as well. And it's very exciting for young pupils, I've found, to discover that, you know, there are remnants of that case structure in English as well. But I think the other side of arguing for Latin's use in particular, and Greek as well, is precisely that it is so deeply intertwined with Europe's historical tradition. And you could, by all means, learn another non-European language and, you know, you might find that your brain is stimulated. I'm sure that there are all kinds of intellectual advantages. But if you're learning Latin and Greek, you are directly in touch with thousands of years of European culture, which has left its mark on everything we might want to read in the world of classics, in anything up to at least, you know, the late 20th century. Mm. So I think that's an advantage. That's something one, you know, actually the other day I saw a review of, this is slightly off topic, a sort of restaurant review by Giles Corran in the Times, which said something like, I come not to praise this restaurant, but to bury. No, I come not to bury this restaurant, but to praise it. That's what it was, wasn't it? And, you know, people are saying, well, why you come to bury a restaurant? And they weren't getting the point that this is, you know, a quotation of Shakespeare.
Guys, the Times comment section has got to raise its level.
Come on. So, you know, there are so many things in our language which are quotations of great literature. And a lot of them go back to the Latin and Greek literature, which is, for many of us, unparalleled in its resources, in what you can read, the vast range of genres that you get in those two languages, which, frankly, I don't think exists in any other language in the world, however wonderful they are.
Well, to be a bit glib, the first great monument of English historical writing is a history of the Roman Empire, the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. So yeah, it's all intertwined. Is there something special about the kind of mental arithmetic that it takes to translate Latin, say, into English because of our vast vocabulary? Is there a kind of sense thing that goes on that makes that peculiarly satisfying?
I think satisfying is the word, because you are sitting there and you're playing with things, and the order is very, very foreign to the way that English works. Yeah. And I think, I mean, it goes back to sort of improving your ability and your kind of ability to sort of conjure good sentences in English as well, because the Latin is so sort of foreign on the page. And it's particularly if you're translating poetry, you have things going over to the next line and you're having to sort of make sense of this. And I think particularly in today's world, we are encouraged to write very short sentences. I think the human brain, there's a lot of research into this, is being sort of changed by the fact that, you know, Twitter, for example, X, you write things which are very, very short. The human brain seems to want to read things which are very, very short. Mm. In Latin, you have the complete opposite. You know, you can be translating some Cicero and you've got 10 lines, essentially, in one sentence to unpack. So to be able to sort of work that out in your head and to be able to reframe it and put it into English that is actually digestible to the modern brain is actually an important
thing. It's a little bit like one of these kind of enormous maths equations where you'd start, you get to the wrong answer, but then you go back and you unpick it and you see where you've got to. Reminds me also a little bit about the pleasure of speaking German for an English speaker, because us as English speakers, I don't know about you guys, but I regularly start sentences without knowing where they're going to end up and just sort of burble. Whereas in German, if you're speaking it as an English people, it's very counterintuitive because you have to have it prepared. Otherwise, it's incomprehensible. Mm. You have to have the subclauses already in your head. Latin is a little bit like that. Armand, what's it been like teaching people to speak Latin? Because we talk about dead languages, but you're bringing it alive.
It's not a dead language. If even if you go to Tuscany today, which I do fairly regularly, you have people say salve. Mm. Mm. to you.
Or Servus
and in
Austria.
In Germany they do that too.
This is Alve. So, you know, in a sense, people are still using words that have been used for thousands of years and go back to their Latin roots. I learned Latin in the very traditional fashion, grammatically using books and texts and learning streams of vocab and so on, principal parts. So I was a bit sceptical. About 7 or 8 years ago, I went to a place in near Rome called the Academia Vivarium Novum, which teaches students all year round entirely speaking in Latin. And there must have been about 20 or more different nationalities there, all speaking Latin, all conversing in this common tongue. And it wasn't just about, you know, what are we having for breakfast or will you pass the salt or whatever. It was talking about philosophy, talking about ancient poetry, dissecting passages of Virgil or Propertius or Tacitus. And, I mean, it was an extraordinary experience because one of my prejudices, for example, had been there was a way of pronouncing Latin. You know, Caesar would have said veni, vidi, vici, and people go sort of, you know, veni, vidi, vici, or veni, vidi, vici, or whatever it is. You know, you've had all sorts of... It doesn't matter at all. It really doesn't matter. I mean, the fact is you had Italians there who might say something like, licet loqui anglice, can we speak in English? Whereas I might say licet loqui anglice. Who cares? You know, it's a bit like someone speaking English who's French or who's Glaswegian. This has a slightly different accent. He says up instead of up. It really doesn't matter what you, how you pronounce it. What matters is making it intelligible and using it as accurately as possible.
But just before we move on from that, this is something that's always fascinated me. Do we know whether the Romans had, what kind of accent they would have had or how distinctive they would have been? I remember my dad's teacher at school said to him that it would have been like Italian in a Liverpudlian accent, but I think he was just saying that to amuse the boys.
I suspect he was saying that because a U is pronounced "uh."
Yeah.
So okay. You'd talk about pudor or whatever. You wouldn't say puddle.
Okay.
Italian, obviously Italian is a direct descendant and something about the Italian way of speaking may well descend from a certain group of Latin speakers in Rome at a certain period. So when you say, how does Latin sound? Yeah. You have to specify. Yeah. I mean, Latin was spoken in England in the 2nd century AD.
And in Hungary till the 19th century.
It was, exactly, you know, but I'm saying, you know, in the ancient world, across a vast territory by people of different nationalities that Rome had conquered, well, they were bound to speak differently.
Yeah. Even the big poets, you think of all, you know, Ovid, Martial, Catullus, none of them came from Rome.
No.
They came from us, and there was huge regional difference.
Even within Italy, there was regional difference.
Yeah.
And comparable, presumably, with English now as a lingua franca, if you think of the many, many different accents in which English is spoken, even by native speakers of English.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's still English, and that was still Latin. So I think that's one canard, in a way, that you need to get rid of, the idea that we don't know how it's spoken. We have a lot of evidence for how it was spoken, say, in classical times and subsequently. But in the end, that's secondary to it being spoken, which it has been continuously.
Mm.
From ancient times.
When I mean, personal confession, I also studied classics, but again, it would have been, to me, totally out of my comprehension to the idea of speaking Latin, or I'd have felt like it was beyond me, actually. But how have you found your students respond
I have to say, they absolutely love it, and we're getting more and more applications to my college, which is one of the only two that teaches this active Latin in Oxford, as a result of giving that option, which the students don't have in other colleges. We are now having students from other colleges applying to us to do our course, and we're beginning to teach them too.
Yeah.
And the reason is simply that they realise that if you have a fluent grasp, or some kind of fluent grasp of spoken Latin, you're going to approach a text in a very different way. This is a language which is not dead. It's one which was spoken, which was written in all sorts of ways. So there's not just one way of saying a sentence in Latin. We, when I was at school, were taught, you know, this is how you write a Latin prose. And the model was Cicero, a great stylist, a completely unique stylist, the kind of Latin that probably nobody ever spoke, not even Cicero himself, because his letters are not couched in the same Latin as his speeches. So his formal speeches, which is how we were taught to write Latin prose, is not how Latin was heard. So let's jettison the idea there's just one way of writing and speaking Latin. And so the students come to it and they think, well, I feel free, I feel liberated. A few years ago, one of my students, a brilliant young Indian called Yamir Bade, wrote me an essay off his own bat in Latin. I did put it on X. It went viral. Yeah. Wow. Last year, the same happened with a brilliant young student. And they're just doing it for the hell of it, for the fun of it, because they can understand it as a language that can be used.
And so it becomes a creative discipline, because it's one of the most interesting things, I think, when I see the translations that you post, Armand. It's one is the kind of brilliance of them, but also how different they are to one another and how different they are from what has come before, that they're building on an entire tradition, which is hugely different. If one reads, you know, texts of the Iliad, for example, you know, just basic, they are so wildly different, but can be convincing in many different ways. And they are interacting with one another, they're interacting with that tradition, and yet they're always fresh, new, and creative.
Mm. It reminds me a little bit of Ted Hughes' arguments for learning poetry, or at least for reading poetry intensively over and over again. And what he said was, the first time you learn a poem through visual imagery, so it's very difficult to rote learn a poem, and actors won't rote learn, they'll have visual metaphors running through their head while they run lines. The first time, you'll just be on the visual side, and it'll just be your kind of straightforward A to B transliteration of what the words are. The second time you do it, it will be a bit deeper. The third time, it will be actually in your heart, and it will be suddenly you're tapping into an almost subterranean set of influences, of encounters you probably had years back in the culture, and you still suddenly in a personal encounter with what it means to be encountering art and literature. And it's that personal encounter, I think, you're getting at, Paul, that it allows
you
to get to.
Yes, I mean, it is. That's why you have to go back to the source, and that's why you need to still learn Latin, because there may be dozens of different translations, and some will appeal and some won't, and some may be more accurate or get the sense better than others. And somehow, if you don't know the source, you're at sea. And that also goes... I mean, I saw Stoppard's Invention of Love quite recently in the Hampstead Theatre, and lots of things I didn't enjoy about it. The acting was great. But at one stage, one of the young men quotes Catullus' poem, Vivamus, mea lesbia, is what he says. Vivamus, mea lesbia. Now, I cringed because that poem has a particular rhythm, and that word is vivamus. And when I was thinking about vivamus mea lesbiat quamemus, which means let us live and let us love lesbia, it has this wonderful sound of R and A, that the pleasure of him saying, let us live in love, vivamus mea lesbiat quamemus. And then the next line says, and let's count as nothing the gossiping of those horrid old men, which goes, rumores senum severiorum. So you've got this or this grumbling, as opposed to vivamus mea lesbiat quamemus, R-A, and then or. It's just perfect, isn't it? Yeah. It's sort of these vowel sounds that it's produced. If you know what they're doing, it makes so much more sense. Mm,
yeah. That poem has a wonderful, what's the word for sandiness or something earlier on in that poem? Specific, I can't remember. But he's talking about being in the sands. And I remember doing it at school. Mm. And there's a word in it, which I remember, just the class found. So,
Lazar Pikiferis.
And it's kind of the sand. Yeah, that's exactly it.
Lazar Pikiferis, Tarenis. Yes.
But we all were sort of had a great pleasure.
The sand that produces asafoetida, which is a particular herb.
Yeah, that's exactly it. And I remember we were all amazed.
But what they didn't tell
word.
You was that herb was used for contraception.
Right. Okay.
And you see, this is the kind of thing you discover. He is saying to her, you know, let's have a good time, you know, and then he's bringing in this poetic place, Cyrene, which was where Callimachus, the great Hellenistic poet, was born. And you think, oh, it's a very Hellenistic comment. It's this place which, you know, which gives rise to this asafoetida bearing sand. Okay, and he's saying, come on, use your contraceptives.
Well, Catullus was famously like the earlier editions in English are all edited to remove all the nasty dirty.
They were diced. So even the 1974 so-called Red Oxford by Fordyce is, you know, half the naughty poems, all the naughty poems
all
are
naughty
taken
poems
out.
Going out, Alderized versions.
Yeah, but alderized, or indeed, as a classicist called John Henderson put it, are you four-dicing or anti-dicing? He certainly diced it up four-dicing.
Well, that's another argument for it. You can avoid sort of Edwardian censorship, so that's nice.
But I think it's knowing these things which is so makes it so interesting. Yeah. I think this is the thing when you when we're taking up Latin for the first time, you speak to people sort of my parents' generation, they only did the sort of rote learning, was completely divorced from the context, the naughtiness, the kind of descriptions of the poetry that goes with it. And at that time, you're thinking, well, why am I learning all these Latin verbs? What is the point of it? And that probably goes back in time. I remember reading something by, I think it was Thomas de Quincey, right at the beginning of the 19th century. He was saying the Latin texts they used at school at Eton were enough to sort of, I mean, so stuff that they caused as the same amount of human suffering as Nero and Robespierre, you know, and any other sort of human enemy of the human race.
But that's true of language learning in general, isn't it? There's a lot of hard, unrewarding work until you get to that point where it becomes creative. I mean, is that fair?
I think you have to learn the building blocks and you have to sort of learn some rules before you can break them. But that's the same for any discipline.
Of course.
I often compare it to Picasso. Picasso, you look at his early work, wonderfully sort of technically correct artwork, and then you can break those rules. Mm. But it's the manner in which you learn those rules can still be enjoyable. You can still have it meld together.
And as a musician, Armand, there must be similarities as well.
Absolutely. And, you know, use the word unrewarding of learning verbs and things. Well, the fact is, as kids, you learn stuff because, you know, you're given rewards for doing well. And you take it in and, you know, wow, I got 10 out of 10 for my Latin verb test. So you went on to, you know, I've got to make sure I keep that record. Similarly with piano, which I learned from the age of 5, you know, you do have to do your scales. But I had a wonderful teacher who made it fun, actually. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, to do something entirely by rote is never going to be as effective as doing it mindfully. If you're playing a scale, how your fingers are shaped on the piano keys, how you press each of them down from the knuckle and so on. By the time you've started to get into it, you're enjoying every aspect of the learning process and you're learning so much faster.
And there's that physicality to music as well.
There is that physicality as well.
And sensuousness.
Yeah, that's kind of synesthetic as well. I mean, I can remember my pieces because I've got them in my fingers. But I think with Latin, I think Daisy's absolutely right. It's how it's taught.
Yep.
And
yep.
part of the problem, part of the reason for the decline, I'm afraid, is that it was taken for granted as something everyone of any intelligence should be learning. Already a mistake. And secondly, it was taught very badly for a very long time. It was taught in an ultra-disciplinarian fashion. Half of my Latin teachers at school were not like my original Latin teacher, John Evans, who was a wonderfully innovative and creative teacher. The others were horrible, a lot of them, and there were several. Then eventually you find one or two who you can really appreciate. But that is so important, good teaching.
I had a fantastic teacher, Jeremy Fenton, who 1 hour a week, and this was in the real drudge period of learning Latin, like that year where it just feels like you're just learning tables. 1 hour a week, he'd unfold these big A5 pieces of paper that he'd photocopied, and he'd done his own hand drawings of, say, Aeneas's journey from Troy to Rome. And he'd read out passages from the Aeneid and ask us to draw in what we saw. So we'd go through the underworld and draw in the different stages. And it's that kind of visual memory patterns that I remember thinking, you know, I intrinsically this is interesting because it's an intellectual tough challenge, but suddenly you're just seeing it open up visually. Mm. And it's that rote learning. It's very difficult to rote learn anything. Vocab lists are hard, but the moment you inject a visual metaphor, it comes alive. And
yes.
You know, I think Renaissance medieval culture understood that in a way that maybe our sort of post-Reformation culture slightly lost.
Yes.
You know, that kind of emphasis. You know, people like Aquinas are obsessed with mnemonics and having these enormous memory maps in his head because they kind of had to. They had to have these enormous, capacious memories.
No, there's Francis A. Yates's fascinating book, The Art of Memory, that is about that. And of course, that's particularly resonant in an age when we're talking about declining attention spans and what Daisy's already referred to, you know, as people getting used to very short passages. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get constant complaints from academics about reading lists, just partial reading lists now and not reading at all. And that's the very opposite of what Yeats is talking about in that book, that capacity to retain so much information.
Paul, I'd be interested as one of the quotations I introduced the podcast with, which was A. Houseman saying Shakespeare would have been an even greater genius if he'd understood Latin and Greek. But he was comparing Shakespeare to Milton, to John Milton, probably the greatest epic poet in the English language.
Yeah.
And he was saying that that kind of Latinate world in which Milton was so invested in made, kind of elevated Milton. above Shakespeare. What do you make as a sort of 17th century hand?
Well, it's very interesting you say that, because just last week, just the weekend, I was reading T.S. Eliot's two very short essays on Milton. And though Eliot puts it on the record that he considers Milton a genius, he's sceptical about him because I think that he regards himself as almost too prescribed. And ultimately, in Paradise Lost and those later great poems, Eliot accuses him of forgetting the language and just turning it into music, that it almost loses its meaning in a way. And he overdoes the whole thing because he is this person. I mean, Milton is extraordinary in his capacity for languages, ancient and modern. His references are just extraordinary, particularly when you think that Paradise Lost is dictated. You know, this is the stuff he's thinking as he's lying in bed. And then he's dictating it the following day to his two amanuenses. I mean, it is an extraordinary feat. But I think there's also a temptation in Milton to show off that. And of course, he's blind at the time. So therefore, he has this euphonious view of literature, that it becomes music. And sometimes Eliot accuses him of being abstract, like music is. Whereas Shakespeare, because in a way he's educationally half-formed, in a way he's more creative. I mean, he obviously has familiarity with classical, and he certainly has the references.
Well, there, some of it's word for word.
For his sources, and some of it's word for word. But he's also at this crucial point where English is really becoming the English we know. There's a big difference between reading Chaucer and reading Shakespeare, for example. It's still challenging, but you're familiar with it, and so much of it is part of the language anyway and part of our culture. But there's a tension there between the person who is the brilliant technical scholar as well as this great figure, and then this sort of half-formed figure who's also of genius, and contrasting the two is, I think, quite interesting.
And I think Housman was wrong, actually, that Shakespeare is all the greater. And in fact, my friend Michael Wood, who's a great Shakespeare expert, is convinced that Shakespeare had a very good Latin and Greek background at his school. And I think that's probably right. So he has it, but he isn't using it in the way that Milton is, in a very kind of overt fashion.
It's ostentatious.
It is ostentation. And oddly enough, Houseman's poetry, I mean, he knew Latin better than anyone, but you don't find it.
Not at all.
In his poetry at all. It's straightforward, simple, very wonderful. He uses English beautifully, he uses rhyme beautifully, as you know. And so I don't think you have to, you know, you can be steeped in Latin and Greek. You don't have to become a Milton.
Yeah.
I mean, there is an argument for having sort of small Latin and less Greek today. I mean, I think that is probably the most that a lot of us can hope to achieve. And actually, that is something. That's a good foundation that will get you further. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a baseline. Yeah.
Except I think small Latin and less Greek doesn't really do justice to how much Latin and Greek Shakespeare almost certainly knew.
No, I'm sure Shakespeare is much more grounded.
But I think also with Shakespeare, there's another element to this that I think, in terms of English there as well, and this is true of both Milton and Shakespeare, and indeed true of the English tradition until very recently, and I think Orwell is to blame for this quite a lot, is this reduction in what you might call a heightened language. Because the other important influences on Shakespeare and Milton would be stuff like the prayer book, which is a heightened language of the English people, which obviously has the influence of Greek in it as well, in Latin. But it's also, there is this sense that it is a heightened language of both economy, extraordinary economy, grammar's language, but also one that is poetic and reaches poetic heights. And it's common. Everyone knows it. Everyone hears it. This heightened language all the time that can trace itself back to Greek and Hebrew and everything else and that ancient world. And that's, again, the continuity. And I feel that that's the great loss. You know, W.H. Auden called the abandonment of the prayer book, you know, why spit on your luck? You know, the English were so lucky to have this, and the wider Anglophone world was so lucky to have this. And it's been abandoned, rather as the ancient languages have been abandoned.
So there's like this English vernacular that grows up in kind of appreciation and contesting with Latin, Greek and Europe. And there's so much correspondence and so much transfer. But what about the English vernacular now? What do Latin and Greek have to say to things like estuary English? I mean, RP is kind of, I guess, the high English that is still in a way the language of the professional class. But even that has sort of become a bit more mutilated. Turn on the radio, and don't want to be too high-minded,
yes,
high court judge about it. But,
right,
you know, there's, you know, people talk about dead and living languages. Modern English is increasingly less eloquent, less communicative, and yet it is the global vernacular. I don't know.
Things do move on, things do change. I mean, I think one doesn't want to be too sort of Luddite about all this and say, you know, I've had to come to terms with certain changes in the way people speak, and you should accept it. You know, I think one has to come to terms with the fact that people use language in a certain way, which is completely comprehensible, and maybe one shouldn't be over Latinate about it. I mean, of course, it was the Latinate idea that got, I think it was Dryden, to say you shouldn't split an infinitive, because of course Latin doesn't. An infinitive in Latin, to come, venire, to do, facere. So you can't say to boldly go in Latin.
Yeah.
You have to say boldly to go. Audacterire. And it sounds perfectly good. But actually, I'm happy to split infinitives from time to time, and I think it makes sense to do so. No reason to make a rule against it.
And as an editor, these are the choices you make on a daily basis. You think, has this changed, has this not? You know, do you remain formal or do you accept those changes?
Yeah. Just to come back to kind of the present, what do you both think is the, we talked about spoken Latin, what is actually the kind of practically the best thing that the state, teachers, individual schools can do? If we think this is important for the health of the country or our culture, what should they actually do?
I think introducing Latin to more schools is a good thing. I mean, I think this is happening. At the same time, there's been a lot of focus on introducing ancient history and Class Civ to state schools in particular first. A lot of the programmes we've spoken about, Classics for All, Latin Excellence Programme is a separate thing. There are lots of things going on. There's a new Centre for Classics Teaching. Arlene Holmes Henderson has done a lot to promote and support the teaching of classics. That's opened at Durham recently, and it's called Caris. I think I read like the goddess. Anyway, I think all these initiatives are really, really good. Getting some classics into schools, that the argument seems to run, is better than necessarily starting with Latin. And I can see the rationale behind that. I can see that having some background in Class Civ will give you the initiative to then take up Latin. You see why you're studying it. But having Latin also on offer, I think, is really, really important.
But beyond that as well, there seems to be the STEM world. If we think of the two cultures and the contest between two cultures, it's STEM that seems to be the dominant aspirational thing to do, while the humanities in general feels like it, you know, doesn't get, you know, the time of day, really. What's that further argument? What's the argument you can make to people that says having a robust humanities, a robust, serious humanities discipline in this country is not just good for us and for, you know, those lovely things, those sense of beauty and sensoriness and all that, but it's good for the economy, good for our political state, all that stuff?
Well, I'd say, I mean, trends come and go, don't they? I mean, I think, you know, STEM, very important, and we can look at what we think is going to be helpful for the immediate future now. But then if you look back over 2,000 years, you think, actually, what has stayed the course? Latin has. You know, you have to look back and understand that and take the long view sometimes.
You think of the example of Lucretius, for example, when he was reimagined in the mid-17th century, the time of the Royal Society. You know, there's a lot of scientific engagement within the ancient world as well. And that's reimagined, you know, as we've talked about, reimagining the classics over and over again. And that remained important in the mid-17th century. I think also, you know, a lot of people who are the tech bros have a background in this. Mark Zuckerberg, the most obvious figure, is a classicist. I mean, he's done fairly well. You know, there are a lot of people. I mean, there's the famous, you know, this utilitarian emphasis on STEM, and of course it's absolutely important, STEM, but the utilitarian idea is never a good one. And I think there's a wonderful speech that Steve Jobs gave to his liberal arts university on his discovery of calligraphy. But the great leap for Apple was not the technology. The technology was widely available. What it was the way he made it accessible and usable to the world. And he did that through the kind of insights he gained on a course that they wanted to close down because there was a lack of interest and it was not seen as useful, calligraphy. And yet it completely transformed, you know, one and made possible one of the largest companies on earth.
And there's a good reason, likewise, why, you know, Thucydides is still being studied at West Point. You know, and in military academies, people look at the Melian dialogue, they look at sort of rationale for sort of neutrality in war. These texts are still seen to be important. I think General Petraeus was reading these. Lots of people through history have all read this. Mm. It's not just something like back in time. It's in more recent history as well.
Yeah. And I think what the argument for classics actually just kind of leads you into is an argument for just reading in general and deep literacy. That why would you cut yourself off from incredibly powerful coping mechanisms, incredibly powerful ways into the world that have been developed over hundreds of years? I think historian Neil Ferguson said, put it something like this, that, you know, you've got a million lifetimes available to you to read about, you know, not just the wisdom of your own generation or your parents' generation. You've got access to thousands of years of knowledge.
Why? Genius in, genius out.
Exactly. So, yeah, God, thank you so much for coming on. That was really fascinating. And yeah, thanks, Armand, Daisy, thank and you. Paul. That was brilliant. And yeah, I think just like to end on some recommendations in terms of classical texts. What's the kind of number one recommendation you'd have for someone coming at it completely blind? You know, if they had lived in a dark room for, you know, forever, what would the first thing you presented to them saying, you know, this is the thing to read about in the classical world?
Well, in terms of classical texts, in translation, probably I'd start with the Odyssey.
Okay, yeah. Armand?
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting choice because it is readable and fun. And there's, I think, a very lively and fun new translation by Emily Wilson of it, which I know has its detractors, but still a lot of people are enjoying. I might go for, well, I went to a school in Peckham a few years ago where there were students who knew nothing of classics. And I just took Poem 85 of Catullus and put it in front of them. Odi et amo, I hate and I love. How I do that, perhaps you ask. I don't know. But I feel it and I'm torn in two. That's what he says. And I put it in front of them and we went through it word by word. I said, Odi, what do you think? And they immediately got odious et. Oh, French, a means and, yes, amo, oh, amore. It's like, hey, we know all these words already. Okay, well, this is what it means. And then some of them were started to come up with amazingly creative understandings of the crisscross shape of the poem. And it was like, wow, Latin is wonderful. And I think you need to try and get that across. So maybe I'd give them a book of Catullus with all the naughty bits in there, nicely translated.
That's important.
And in fact, someone did say when I posted a naughty Catullus online, if this is the kind of thing that I'd been learning at school, I'd have enjoyed Latin so much more.
Well, on that note, thanks very much for listening, listeners, and we'll be back soon. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to EI Talks, an Engelsberg Ideas podcast. Engelsberg Ideas is funded by the Axel and Margaret Axon Johnson Foundation for Public Benefit. The sound engineer is Gareth Jones, and EI Talks is produced by Alistair Benn. Till next time, thanks for listening.